Sorry, lieve luisteraar. Oh jee. Oeps, ja. Nou ja, alles is mislukt. Oh nee. Ja, ik weet niet of we nou nog aan het uitzenden zijn. Ja. Nou, het is in die zin mislukt dat ik dacht, ik kan mijn eigen boontjes gaan doppen onder het luisteren van de autoriteit. Maar dat is niet gelukt. Wat wel gelukt is, is boontjes. Ik heb 10 bonen mogen oogsten. En die heb ik zitten doppen. Daar ging het om. En ik heb ze nog niet geteld. Hoeveel boontjes eruit gekomen zijn. Sommige zijn echt heel mooi. En sommige zijn heel klein. Even kijken. Nou, 2, 4, 6, 8, 10, 12, 15. 15 boontjes gedopt. En nou, er zijn er zeker 1, 2, 3, 4 zijn er heel kansrijk om volgend jaar weer uit te groeien tot nieuwe bonen. Nou, en daar ging het om. Dus, en ondertussen is het ook opgeruimd en netjes weer beneden op de straathoek. Dus nou, dat was het. En nou, ja, er komt nog een andere uitzending. Sowieso morgen vanuit Baren, heel waarschijnlijk. Ik weet nog steeds niet of ik het wel aandurf, maar... En eerder misschien ook al, want misschien is er wel wat te melden over de Green Tribe. De oplettende luisteraar weet dat de Green Tribe voor de 3e keer verhuisd is in korte tijd. Althans de voorhoede. En nu is er een landje wat blijft. En daar hebben ze hulp nodig. En die hulp kun je geven ja, langs de A5. Als je bij Sloterdijk de Bretten in fietst. Richting de Heining. Dan ga je voordat je de A5 onderdoor gaat, kijk je naar rechts. En daar kan je alles doen wat je wil. Bij de Green Tribe. En nou, dus blijf luisteren naar Radio Paddepoel, want er komt altijd meer. Maar je weet nooit wanneer.
No one's faith is shaking. Their vision lies. Walking down the road. Tell me, how long you gonna stay here, Joe? Some people say this town don't look good in snow. You don't care, I know.
Ventura Highway. Are stronger than moonshine. You're gonna go, I know. Cause the free wind is blowing through your hair, and the days surround your day.
waiting for the early train. Sorry, boy, but I've been hit by a purple rain. Oh, come on, Joe, you can always change your name. Thanks a lot, son, just the same.
Venture a highway in the sunshine, where the days are longer, the nights are stronger than moonshine. You're gonna go, I know. Crying, no despair, alligator lizards in the air, in the air.
Episode 2. In the autumn of 1915, Lisa, and a year later, Dima, began to study at secondary school. Travel to Britain was still out of the question, however, so I stayed on with the Corbelives, as all their former employees appeared to do. I caught a tram each morning up the Boulevard Ring to a school on Terskaya Street, where I gave English lessons, and walked the children back from school in the afternoon. The post became erratic, and communication with my parents infrequent. What, after all, had I left behind in Britain? My brothers had moved away, and all that awaited me in Truro was my father, who seemed to dislike me, and my mother, who thought me unnatural. At home, my mother used to bewail unanswerably, "What are we to do with you?" In Moscow, I felt I'd found a reply for her. Then, in November 1916, I received a letter through the diplomatic bag in my father's dark, decisive hand. "Dear Gertrude, it is with profound sadness that I write to tell you that your brother Edmund has been killed in action on the Somme at Ancre on the night of 16th-17th October." I suppose it was unfair of me to blame my parents for Edmund's death. Even if they did encourage him to join up, they'd done no more than millions of other families. And yet, as I reread that letter now, I feel a rush of the rage I harboured against them for years. I never wanted to see them again. I ripped up their unread letters. I hid in my room to cry, too angry to accept sympathy. "All true socialists take a defeatist position," said Pasha that winter. The first time I'd heard the term. This war was inevitable. A result of empire, colonial policies produce an excess of weapons, raw materials and manufactured produce. Then they need a war to soak up the glut and keep the prices high. And the irony is, because the result can only be chaos and the destabilisation of the regime, it's bringing the revolution closer every day. Pasha! I was so angry I shook all over. I never thought I would hear you say such a disgraceful, cynical thing. If the revolution depends on the death of innocent young men, it isn't worth a jot. "Oh, Gertie, I'm sorry." He came towards me, but I rushed out of the room. It was Nikita Slavkin who set things right, knocking on my door late at night. "Miss Gertie, may I talk to you? I think you misunderstood." "Do you? Please, let me explain. We socialists would abolish war entirely. And we agree that the blood of a single human being is more valuable than any notions of patriotism." He sat down, not looking at me. "It's primitive behaviour. My mother died just as stupidly for no reason at all, of a minor infection after childbirth. My father would not take her to the hospital. He sat and prayed over her. If she'd been treated, she would still be alive." He said gently, "At least let your brother's death mean something. Revolution will redeem all these sacrifices." Slavkin had grown in authority over the past couple of years. We often found ourselves turning to him for the final word. It struck me that his childhood in an old believer community, a type of strict orthodox sect, had much in common with my own chapel upbringing. We had both jettisoned a cruel, overweening God, yet against our will we were both left with a sense of loss. We rejected the Father, but we could not rid ourselves of the beauty of the Son's example, or a belief in the unity of all things. I signed up for a course in political education, yet politics always remained opaque to me, however hard I tried. Revolution, on the other hand, or at least the revolution that Slavkin envisaged, was clearly visible. It was the longed-for precipice just downhill of us. On the 3rd of March, Mr. Korbeliev arrived back from his club out of breath, his face scarlet, his eyes full of tears, with the news that the Tsar had abdicated. We embraced each other, cried and rushed out onto the streets, swept up on the general tide of euphoria. It all happened more or less just as a revolution should, with dozens of symbolic moments, the burning of the Tsarist regalia, huge demonstrations in the streets, exultant groups of citizens drinking the contents of a few looted stores. October had none of the ingredients of a people's revolution. No processions, and no symbolic removal of the tyrant's flag, because there was no tyrant by then. There was street fighting in Moscow, but thank goodness not too close to Gagarinsky Lane. In late October, I remember, snow threatened but did not come. Mr. Korbeliev telephoned friends of his in the city council and learnt that the Bolsheviks had driven out the provisional government. We could hear heavy fighting in other parts of the city, so we settled in at Gagarinsky Lane and played card games with the children to pass the time. After 5 days, it finally began to snow, and the city fell quiet. Pasha and Nikita were keen to find out news, and I volunteered to go with them. We turned towards the centre of town. Pasha and Nikita were deep in conversation and did not include me. It was the middle of the afternoon, but the streets were almost empty. On Mokhovaya Street, Pasha said, "What's that?" And we saw the body of a man in the road. From the way he was lying, awkwardly, his leg bent beneath him, it was clear from a distance of 50 yards that he was dead. Snow had already settled on his face and his clothes. The three of us passed him on the other side of the road. We did not say another word about it. But after a few moments, I realised that we were on Vozhdovnshchanka. "Perhaps..." My voice came out in a croak. I cleared my throat and tried again. "Perhaps we might drop in and see Miss Clegg and the Beloborodovs." "Yes, yes," agreed Pasha with relief. And Slavkin, as if noticing that I was with them for the first time, turned to me, smiled and nodded. I felt an absurd self-congratulatory flush. We entered the Beloborodovs' large, modern apartment, and Miss Clegg brought us into the drawing-room to join the family. Monsieur Beloborodov was talking with his brother-in-law, Prince Svetinsky, in front of the fireplace. Madame was quite young, although she adopted the glorious, condescending airs of a dowager. "Little Miss Freely," she drawled from her chair, "do sit down with us." We drank weak tea from little porcelain cups and spoke of this and that. Prince Svetinsky, who is a collector of minerals, spoke of a rare specimen, Jeremijevite, that he had found for sale in the market. Slavkin perked up. "I thought only a few examples were known." The prince's little black eyes fell on Slavkin. "Are you interested in minerals? You must let me show you my collection." They fell into conversation.
"Is your friend at the university?" murmured Madame Beloborodov.
"Yes, he's studying physics and engineering, but he also attends lectures in the geology faculty. He seems to know all the professors."
"Really?
Prince Svetinsky and his wife have had some bad luck. A fire in his house on Miznitskaya. His collection, thank heavens, was unharmed. Now they plan to sell it and leave for France."
"I see," I replied slowly, wondering why I was being favoured with this confidence.
"Perhaps," she breathed scarcely audibly to me, "your friend might have connections in the university who would be interested."
A few weeks later, we spent several days packing and sorting the pieces at the prince's house. I was finishing up a last few tasks when the prince came up to the gallery for the first time. He went straight to his study without greeting us, and Nikita immediately hurried over to speak to him. I could not see the prince, who was concealed behind the door of his study, or hear their conversation, yet I read its course clearly in the lines of Nikita's body. He plucked nervously at his sleeve and shuffled from foot to foot, backing away from the fury directed at him. He shook his head.
Now the prince raised his voice. "Robbery! They never had the slightest intention to pay!"
Nikita, cowering before him, still shook his head. "That wasn't what we arranged. I had no idea." He flinched as though he'd been hit. The study door slammed shut. He walked slowly back towards me. "He says they forced him to sign the collection over to the state." We set out through the darkening streets towards Gagarinsky Lane, and he went over and over the episode. I suppose now the collection will be at the service of the people, I said at last, timidly. He looked at me for a moment, as if about to say something, then changed his mind. He stood up a little straighter, then quite unexpectedly he took my arm and tucked it under his slow, sweet smile lighting up his face. Gertie, I think you must be the most rational, sensible woman I know, he said. We walked together through the icy streets and past the central post office, pockmarked with bullet holes. His arm felt very warm against mine. The Svertinskys donated their collection to the Soviet state against their will, and in return were permitted to leave for France. The Svertinsky theft, as the episode became known in émigré circles, brought Slavkin the approval of the Bolshevik leadership and a position at the newly established Centre for Revolutionary Research, where he began his work on iridium alloys, the first step towards the socialisation capsule. One May evening in 1918, I couldn't sleep. I leaned out of the open window, gazing into the dark spring night. A car, its headlights extinguished, cruised quietly down Gagarinsky Lane. Underneath my window, it stopped, and several men jumped out. They ran up to the gate and banged loudly. This was not the first time that the house had been searched, but the other occasions had been in daylight, and we'd had some warning to hide incriminating possessions. I darted along to Mr. Korbeliev's study. His gun, a Mauser, was lying quite openly on the sideboard. People were shot for less. I thrust it into my bodice, then ran to Mrs. Korbeliev's room. "Wake up, Sofia Pavlovna, dear. The militia are here," I said, shaking her. "Give me your jewels, quickly." She sat up and fumbled in the chest of drawers by her bed, pulling out several velvet bags. I could hear voices in the hall downstairs shouting for Comrade Korbeliev. "He's at work," Pasha told them. I peeped over the banisters. There were perhaps four or five of them, swaggering and nervous. One of them casually swept the large china letter dish off the hall table. It chimed like a bell as it smashed. "Who are you?" said Pasha. "Show me your identification." "Comrade Korbeliev, I'm the deputy head of the Smolensk District Soviet." A man pushed forward to talk to Pasha. I saw it was Prigorian, who had been the Korbeliev chauffeur until the car was requisitioned. He'd always been the image of deference. And now he stood with his legs apart and rested his hand on his gun holster at his belt. "The people are concerned that your father has been carrying off the treasures he expropriated from the nation." "You mean his collection?" I was impressed by Pasha's calm tones. "You know perfectly well, Prig. Nothing has been carried off. My father has preserved large numbers of works of art for the Russian people." "Search the house," Prig told the others, without looking around. Episode 3. They moved towards the stairs, and I ran to my bedroom and shoved the jewels and gun under my mattress. My heart was thrashing about in my chest. Voices were raised. There was a crash of a table being overturned. "Open up, or we'll arrest you all," I could hear them saying outside Mrs. Korbeliev's room. I waited in my room. "Open up! Open up at once!" They thumped on my door. "Certainly not," I said in my most haughty tones. "I am a British citizen. You have no right to search my room." I opened the door a sliver and showed them my passport. In silence, they examined it, one after the other. Prig was called. "It's true. She's an Anglichanka," he said, looking at me distastefully. To my amazement, they moved on. Half an hour later, they were gone. When Mr. Korbeliev returned home, I went to see him in his study. For the first time since I'd lived in the house, Mrs. Korbeliev was sitting with him. I gave them back their belongings. "Good Lord, Miss Gertie, How can we thank you? No, no, don't thank me. But, sir, is it safe for you all here in Moscow? I've always said the moral course is to remain. Korbelov began, then checked himself, looking at his wife. I don't know. Mrs. Korbelov, very pale but upright, suddenly spoke. I think we should go south for the summer. Will you accompany us, Miss Gertie? No, Sofia Pavlovna, I must stay in Moscow, I told her gently. The embassy had advised British citizens to remain in the capital in case of evacuation. But perhaps you'd like me to protect the house as far as possible. We spent the next 3 days packing away Mr. Korbelov's ethnographic collection. Then we hired a cart and transported them to the Alexander III Museum, which had agreed to store the collection. Mr. Korbelov had procured tickets for them to Yalta. Sonia's husband had returned to Petrograd. Sonia herself decided to accompany her parents south, but the old ladies refused to move. Mr. Korbelov was in despair. No argument would change their minds, and as I promised to care for them as best I could, Mr. Korbelov finally agreed they should remain. He insisted on leaving me the Mauser, which I took with some trepidation, having no idea how to load or fire it. It was another lilac-scented day in May when the old carriage was loaded up and a horse was hired to take them to the station. "Goodbye, Miss Gertie," said Pasha, doffing his cap and grinning at me. "Now I'll never be able to convince you how much I love you." I laughed. "Pasha, you are ridiculous." I stopped. He had already turned away and was talking to Yasha, telling him to drive on. In the end, the Korbelov family left the house on Gargorinsky Lane almost without noticing, talking and arguing among themselves. I was working longer hours than ever at the English school on Terskaya, lessons that were now paid mainly in kind. One pupil, a Georgian, presented me with a bag of good black tea. All the old ladies were happy. "Take some, do, to that strange boy," said Anna Vladimirovna. At my knock, Slavkin opened his door, even a little too quickly, as though he were waiting for me, and made me jump, and some of the precious tea was spilt. I had never seen the inside of his room. The walls were covered in notes and equations, pieces of newspaper, scribbles, and rather beautiful sketches. In one corner was a camera on a tripod, and in another a heap of rubbish. Broken wooden crates, bits of old planking, dirty bottles, rags, stones. "Goodness," I said. "This is your work?" I was conscious of a note of incredulity and added, "Perhaps one day you will explain it to me." I turned to leave, embarrassed. "Wait." He took a step towards me. "Why are you here? Why didn't you go south?" What do you mean?" I stammered. "You know why, but British citizens have been told to stay in Moscow." "I don't think you remained here just for reasons of safety," he said quietly. "I don't know. I felt there'd be something for me to do here."
"For the revolution?"
"Well, yes." He gazed at me, and I had an extraordinary sensation, as though it were the first time in my life that anyone had really looked at me. Later that night, I lay in bed and listened to the wind, an unsettling tune with no comfort in it. I sat up. There was someone at my door.
"Who is it?"
Slavkin, a tall, awkward figure silhouetted in the doorway.
"It's me, comrade. You weren't sleeping, were you?"
His voice gave way a little.
"No."
He approached my bed. I did not move. My mouth was dry. He crouched beside me and spoke in a ponderous monotone. "Comrade Freely, I have long thought you a very rational, intelligent woman. I have known your positive attitude to the revolution and to women's rights for some time, but when you told me your reasons for staying in Moscow, it struck me that you would see my situation clearly without sentiment. I hope I deduced this correctly." He gulped audibly. In the half-light, I saw his Adam's apple leaping up and down in his throat. "In order for me to work productively, certain physical comforts are occasionally necessary. For some time, I have been wanting urgently to visit you with the proposal that we might become intimate, so to speak. That in the light of the new world we are building, we might ourselves enjoy free, mutually satisfactory. He hesitated. For a moment, my mind whirled. Then I noticed that he was trembling, the hand clutching his knees, white-knuckled. I reached across and touched him. Suddenly we were together, and he was kissing my face and pushing up my nightdress, and we were both shaking with urgency, and I was only astonished that I had never felt his hands on my waist before, or touching my breasts. And he was hurrying, and pressed himself upon me, cried out, and a moment later fell still. The whole had taken perhaps 5 minutes. My heart was galloping. I could not quite understand what we had done. After a while, Nikita raised himself from me, stood up and straightened his clothes. "I greatly value and respect your honesty and your generosity," he said, serious as ever. I sat up, flooded with shame. I covered myself with a sheet. "Oh, I see. Well, good night then. I'm tired," he said, retreating. "A peaceful night." When he was gone, I got out of bed, took off my nightdress and washed, staring at myself in the mirror. My shame evaporated, and I was filled with joy. Shame? No, no. Here in Soviet Russia, there was no place for shame. Here, men and women were equal. We were honest with each other, and we had no time for sentiment. I could hear my mother's poisonous tones. "I'm afraid you're not the type men like, dear." Every cell in my body rejoiced that night. She was wrong, wrong, wrong. The Civil War brought news of more horrors every day. In July, they reported that the Romanovs were killed. The poor girls. The little boy. I didn't tell the old ladies. I spent my evenings playing canasta with them, my ears pricked for the sound of the front door closing behind Slavkin. Then I excused myself and went to bed, waiting, shivering with excitement, under the covers for the door to open quietly and Nikita's long silhouette to approach. Afterwards, we would lie in my bed and drink Armenian brandy. Nikita would talk, imagining a new way of living. Together, we planned a commune, a place where a group of us could live together and be moulded and changed by communal living, its problems and its rewards, into real revolutionaries, people capable of building communism. But the Korbelis, what would they think? Well, the alternative is Prig and his louts. They will be back any day now to give these rooms away. This way we can choose suitable participants rather than have to take Prig's people. Nikita was not the only one to have this idea. Ideological communes were springing up all over Moscow. They were a rational response to the life we found ourselves living with such scarce resources and such high hopes. So we invited Fyodor Kuzmin, a student friend of Pasha's, to join us, and Volodya, the yardman's son, when he returned from the army. Marina and Vera Gettler, neighbours and old family friends, agreed as well. Together, we wrote a manifesto. For the first time in my life, I felt that I was engaged in a mighty, vitally important task. I had never been so happy. One evening, towards the end of August, Nikita and I heard a muted knocking and voices at the front door. We leant out of the window into the warm summer night. Two figures were waiting in the street. We could hardly make them out in the twilight. "Who's there?" Nikita called quietly. "Good Lord, can that really be you, Nikita?" came a familiar voice. "Get down here at once, you dog. Open the door to us." Pasha and Sonya Korbeliv had returned to Moscow. Outside Yalta, the Korbelivs had found a small villa to rent and had installed themselves safely. "Oh, they're quite happy," Pasha said. "But Sonya and I decided to come back to do our bit for the revolution and all that." The following day, Nikita drew me aside and said, without looking me in the eye, "We've always been friends, comrade. I hope you will do me the honour of remaining my friend, even if certain aspects, which were always quite separate from our friendship, are no longer appropriate to our relationship." Part of me had guessed immediately what he was about to say, but nonetheless I was silenced for a moment. I sat on the stairs. The fact is that now Pasha and Sonia are here and all our members are about to move in, the time has come to devote ourselves to the commune. Do you see? We must all make sacrifices, and our physical intimacy is one of them. We cannot have couples with secrets and so on, forming divisions within the group. We must be a collective. I said nothing, determined not to cry. To my horror, he crouched down in front of me and put his hands on my shoulders. "I must tell you, Gertie, how grateful I am for your friendship. I've never known anyone like you. You have taught me so much about the human spirit, what generosity it is capable of. With you in the commune, I think we have a chance of making it work." He gave me a little squeeze and left. Was it my imagination? Or was he almost jaunty as he stepped out of the front door? I lay hunched over on the stairs for a long time, feeling the sharp edges of the mahogany panelling pressing into the skin of my forehead. Tears dripped onto the stair carpet, soaked in and disappeared. Then I heard someone coming and struggled upright, straightening my clothes. So, at the end of August 1918, the Korbeliev's house on Gargarinsky Lane became the Institute of Revolutionary Transformation. And we, its raw materials, aching to be transformed. Episode 4. The day began in the IRT with the clanging of Mr. Korbeliev's huge copper gong, one of the few possessions of his that still remained in the house. At 6:30, we sat down to eat breakfast in the airy, high-ceilinged dining room with its large windows giving onto the garden, and listened while one of the members read something suitable, Gorky, perhaps. A relief, as the food was best not dwelt on. It was usually kasha, buckwheat porridge, or perhaps blandinka, as we called millet porridge, with salt fish. Even in the summer, when supplies were relatively plentiful, there was already the sensation of dread before you'd started your bowl. The last spoonful was drawing near. You took smaller and smaller bites, and you savoured the feeling of food on your tongue, in your mouth. You never swallowed too quickly. The only way to overcome hunger was to welcome it in. After we'd scraped our bowls clean, if it was not a working day, we sat in the garden and debated how to run the commune. The men's dormitory was Mr. Korbeliev's bedroom, while at first the female members of the commune had the small separate bedrooms at the back of the house. Then Dr. Marina disagreed with this arrangement. A motion was carried unanimously, and the following week the three back bedrooms were knocked into one. Sonia, Dr. Marina, Vera and I moved in together. "The children seem to be turning everything upside down, Miss Gertie," Anna Vladimirovna kept saying querulously. "In my day, father would have sent them to bed with no supper." "Well, that's more or less what happens these days too." "Nothing to worry about," Vera soothed them. Vera, who wasn't remotely interested in politics, was probably the most generous and selfless communard of all of us. She often helped me with the old ladies, who adored her. "Let's listen to the gramophone, shall we?" Dr. Marina and Vera had brought the gramophone with them, and in the evenings we danced on the lawn. Pasha asked his aunt to dance, and Nikita led out a shy and delighted mamselle.